Hello all, and welcome to Satellite, Profile Theater's podcast that tries to help deepen our audience's connection to and understanding of our work and the artist with whom we're working. I'm Tamara Carroll, Profile Theater's Director of Community Engagement, bringing you our first episode orbiting the upcoming production of Reggie Hoops, written by Christopher Diaz and directed by Melissa Crespo. Profile audiences will know Chris's work from two productions last season. The first was Chad Deity, which took audiences into the performative world of pro wrestling, and then Welcome to Arroyos, one of Chris's early plays, which was set in Manhattan's Lower East Side and featured two local DJs, a local graffiti artist's work, and explored hip-hop culture and family legacy. The upcoming world premiere of Reggie Hoops also explores themes of legacy and pro sports as the title character Reggie and her wife Bells try to navigate a very different American dream than what Reggie's parents imagined for her. It's about family, race, gender, sexuality, and the NBA, but it's also not about those things, but it's also about all of those things. One thing it definitely is about is being stacked with a phenomenal cast, some of whom are seasoned Profile veterans, some are new to Profile. All of them are just the absolute best of our local talent. So that is Reggie Hoops. I have not loved getting to know and getting to talk to a playwright about their work quite as much as I have really enjoyed getting to know Chris Diaz and his work over the past couple years. Chris was really generous to give me pretty much his entire lunch break during rehearsal last week, during his first week of rehearsals for Reggie Hoops. Loved getting to chat with him, and I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed talking to him. So here we are in the basement one more time of the Imago Theater. Today I am joined by Christopher Diaz. Chris, how's it going?
Hi, good. It's going good.
It's going good. All right. It's Friday. You got here Monday?
I don't know. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes. It all, when you're in rehearsal in the basement, it all kind of runs together.
Yeah. It's, has it been cool down here at least?
Yeah. When I got here, it was 100, you know, it was 101 that first day. So that was intense, but it's been great down here now.
Yeah. It's good. Beautiful. It's not, this is not typically what you expect from Portland.
No, it's been great. It's been really, really great.
Yeah. So we last talked about this play, I want to say like over a year ago. Mm-hmm. It was right before the convening. Mm-hmm. And I called you. I was in my closet trying to get a little bit of quiet away from the construction noises and be professional. And then you came into town for the convening, had a reading for the convening. We chatted a little bit after that. Mm-hmm. So it's been a year. I don't know. What have you been up to? Any projects?
No.
This past year?
Nothing exciting going on this year.
No?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I was one thing that I was working on. We did a musical with my friend Alicia Keys, and we went to Broadway, and we got 13 Tony nominations, and we won 2 Tony Awards, and we're still running on Broadway.
Yeah. But that's it.
That. I mean, I forgot. Yeah, it's been wild. It's been wild.
Yeah, that's when did that collaboration begin? Like how, when and how?
It started almost 13 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
She wanted to do a musical that used some of her music and was inspired by not her whole life, but by where she grew up. She grew up in this apartment housing complex called Manhattan Plaza, which was open to artists in New York City. And her mom was an actor in New York City at the time, among doing other things, and got into this housing project. Housing project is not the right word, but this housing complex. And it changed Alicia's life, and she wanted to write a musical about it. And somehow I got involved with it, and here we are.
What is it? Are you able to go into any more detail? Around somehow?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know how these things happen.
I've been doing so much press. We've been talking about it. I'm never sure if it's like people are bored with it, but I'll do the quick version. It was shortly after we had done Chad Deity, I think. It was in New York and then in LA. And, you know, maybe within a year or two after that, she had this idea and she brought it to, I think, to her agents at William Morris Endeavor. And they put together a list of folks that wanted to, you know, that might be good fits for helping her put it on the stage. And she's not a stage person. And we had a meeting at her house, not at her house, at a wine cellar somewhere in Soho, New York. And we just talked about like music we liked, and we hit it off really, really, really well. And, you know, lots of other things happened. But from there, we worked together for about three or four years, just the two of us figuring out what we wanted to do. Then we hired Michael Greif to direct. Michael Greif directed Rent, among a million other things, and is a genius. And, you know, we went from there, but it still took, you know, a really long time. And then just as we were ready to do it, then COVID hit. We're glad that it took as long as it did.
Yeah. Thank goodness for COVID, as as we all say every day.
I know, exactly. No, I know. I phrased that really weird. We're glad that we took the time that needed, you know, we're really proud of what it ended up being. And, you know, that part of it, you know, the other thing that was interesting about COVID, here's all the good things about COVID. We got to do a lot of work just on the text, the way that we would have done it as a play, because we did some Zoom workshops, and you can't really do singing on the Zoom in a real effective way. So we just had to sit around the table and do table work. And I think it's a lucky gift in the face of that insane nightmare.
Yeah. Your first musical writing book
My first one that I've been involved with since the very beginning. I did a show in Ashland at Orient Shakes a long time ago, probably right around the time that I first got connected to this, called The Unfortunates. It was a show that had already been created by a group of guys, Ramiz Monsef, John Beavers, and Ian Merrigan, and Casey Hurt. And they had made something, and then I got brought in kind of half dramaturg, half collaborator. So I'd been around musicals a little bit. And then while we were working on Hell's Kitchen, I went to work on an adaptation of Disney's film Hercules that we did in Central Park. So I was working on those kind of simultaneously. But this was the first real one that we sort of crafted from the ground up.
Cool. Well, speaking of plays that have gone through a lengthy-ish development process, as I recall, Reggie Hoops, which is what we are getting ready to premiere, was initially commissioned by a university?
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Yeah, Temple University in Philadelphia.
Right. I'm curious about what... adapting is not right the word, but you know, shifting it from a university production where, you know, you're thinking about students and even in that context, I think we talked about you really worked with them. It was really written for the folks that were going to be performing it. So what has it been like to think about moving it to a script that can be, you know, performed in a lot of different contexts and in this context?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's tricky. So yeah, we started that back in, it was 2016. So it takes me too long to get stuff done, I guess. But we started working on that, and I was writing for specific graduate actors at Temple, and we had a good run, but the world changed in the midst of doing that production. I started doing it in the buildup to the 2016 presidential election. And this is a play about a woman who becomes sort of the first, the highest ranking behind the scenes official in the National Basketball Association. And it was being created in the midst of thinking that we were headed for the first female president of the United States. And we did the first reading the night before the election. And then the election happened and we were like, oh, this is very different. Speaking of another, you know, crazy nightmare that we've lived through. So all that stuff happened and the play had to change. And there were some elements that were really connected to, I think, things that were happening politically. But, you know, you sometimes you think you know what the play is about. You think you know what the container of the play is. And then changes in the world make you rethink that big thing. So the world, the play hasn't changed a ton structurally. The scenes are the scenes. The characters are the characters. The themes are the themes. But it's taken me a while to figure out, you know, the subtle but vastly important difference of like, this is what the thing is actually about. This is the main thing that's actually about. And this is how that elevates and escalates and evolves over the course of the play. You know, so it's a big chunk of that has been just working by myself to try to figure it out. And then Josh invited me down here to work on it a couple of years ago. And a kind of shocking amount of time invested in a play, a new play. New plays don't always get this kind of time. And when I say shocking, but it shouldn't be shocking, but like it is, this is what it should be. Take time over some, over 2 years, get it right, figure out what it is. And then we were able to sort it out. We did the great, reading at the, it's not up to me to judge if the reading was great. We had a great process, for a reading last year at the Playwrights Convening and, working alongside Chris Pena and learning a lot from Chris, at the same time, because, RR and Sky and Reggie Hoops have a lot of thematic elements, that are similar. So we learned that. And then, in preparation for this production, we brought in Melissa Crespo to direct, found the actors that were going to be the right, you know, folks to tell it. And now we're getting to a place where after all that time, I definitely know what the container is. I definitely know what the play is about. And it feels like we're really, really, really in good, good shape.
Yeah, can you...
this is so weird. Like, the screen is in front... No, this is part of the podcast. It's going to sound like I was trying to do something.
No, it's good.
But it's like, the screen is in front of us. And so, like, we're sitting, like, right, like...
It's true.
...looking at the screen, but I'm having a conversation with you. So I'm going to adjust slightly so that I'm sort of looking at you. Not
that's
too
much. That's great. No, that's fine. I honestly... I've personally discovered that for my own brain, it's better for me not to be looking at the person that I'm talking to.
I'm going to look this way then.
That's great.
Cheat towards you.
I'm not going to look at you, but it doesn't mean that I don't. It doesn't mean I'm not interested in what you're saying.
That's fair.
It's that too much of my mental energy gets spent on thinking about what my face is supposed to look like when I am actively listening, and then I'm not actively listening because I'm just making my face look like I'm actively listening, and then I can't think about what you're saying. So this is
okay. Good. That's good. I don't want to be rude too and be like, I'm looking at your screen rather than looking at you. But I get it. I feel you. That makes
makes a ton of sense. That's fine. I think what I love about the era that we're in is that we're starting to like understand that like so many different people's brains work differently and that they need different things to, you know, be successful in different tasks. And, So that's, I'm just like more comfortable being like, nope, I'm just not going to look, I'm just not going to look at you. Despite my intense, respect and love.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. I'm curious. So I remember when we talked before and certainly after the convening, it was like, yep, I don't think very much is going to change. I don't think very much is going to change about this play. And yes, the scenes are still the scenes structurally, like, there are no new scenes that I really remember. I think like some, but like also there have been changes absolutely throughout. What feel like some of the important ways to you that the show has changed, even though subtly?
Yeah. A lot of what I think we figured out between last year and this year was some order of operations kind of stuff. If this goes first, then that has, you know, this, then the second thing makes more, has more of an impact. It's a weirdly structured play. It's a deceivingly complicated structurally. It's, I mean, it, on stage, it's just people sitting in a house and, you know, a couple flashbacks mixed in. But in terms of the way that we're telling story, the way that things are moving chronologically and backwards, and in terms of acting and character motivation, and you know, it's not entirely the way that I would have written other things before. So a lot of it, again, is just figuring out vocabulary, figuring out, you know, what it is that you're doing. But we moved a few things around, and one of the biggest changes from last year actually was, it's a play that about a character, Reggie Hoops, who's trying to make up her mind about this job offer. And at some point in the last year, in thinking about how to execute that, I came to the realization that I don't think she's actually trying to make up her mind. I think she's made up her mind very early in the play, if not before the play begins. And it doesn't change a lot of the write. That doesn't necessarily change a lot of the writing. It doesn't necessarily change things in a way that an audience might consciously recognize that straightforward. But for me to come to land in that place and say, like, oh, it's not, if it's not about a person trying to make a decision, then what is it actually about? Because you need some kind of motivation, some kind of action, some kind of change that she's going through, and figuring out how to play with that, and scene by scene, even sometimes that motivation kind of changes and shifts. And also realizing that maybe perhaps the people who are changing or making decisions in their lives are the people who are interacting with Reggie, as opposed to Reggie interacting with them. So there's lots of that kind of stuff that feels more, it feels more like nerdy writer dramaturgical stuff. But it is vital for when you're working with the actors, because the actors have to know these things. But B, if you can't crack that as a writer, then it becomes very, very difficult to figure out why something's not working. And then once that was the thing that really unloosed, like, oh, okay, if this is the case, if she's already made up her mind, then this scene doesn't necessarily make sense the way it's written, or this has to be flipped around. So those kinds of, you know, aha moment decisions are the kinds of things I think really worked on this year.
One of the ways I see it being similar to Our Orange Sky, right, is it has this generational aspect of what parents want for their children, and a sense of responsibility that children have to their parents for the choices that they make in their life, and the way your parents affect or imprint on you what it means to be successful, what success looks like, what you should be striving for, what it means to make them proud or have achieved what they wanted for you. Mm-hmm. In Our Orange Sky, it's very much through a lens of immigration. Mm-hmm. But there's a similar, whereas like in Our Orange Sky, right, you have these parents from Honduras who came very explicitly, like, we can't give our kids the opportunities if we stay there that we want them to have access to. And then a lot of, you've got like three different siblings who have gone pretty different directions in how they have used that wealth and opportunity that their parents. So it's also, there's also like a way in which Chris's family, or rather Orlando's family, but Chris's family, right? Like in his lifetime, when he was a child, like went from being pretty poor and living in a certain kind of circumstance to having like a lot of affluence and living in a certain circumstance, mm-hmm. and the like doors that opened up. So I guess that's a parallel that I see, right? Reggie and Muncie's family, they don't move out of a different country, but they move from the Bronx, right, to Westchester?
Yep.
Yeah. Scarsdale?
Yep.
Okay, great. So, and it is like a much shorter distance, but it's also worlds apart. There's not a question. I'm just making sure I understand the play. No, there should be a question.
No, I think that it's really astute, and it's a really good description. And yeah, I mean, they're two plays that are, they have similar trappings. Like they're both, Chris and I are both working out the same thing, which is surprising to us when we got here, because we were like, yeah, we're both Latino, but of different, very different backgrounds and very different. You know, he's a gay man. I'm not. He's from the West Coast. I'm from the East Coast. Like, you know, we've just got very different vibes. And, you know, I'm married and have kids and he doesn't. And, you know, he's the biggest extrovert in the American theater. And I'm decidedly less so. But we were working on the same project in some way. Like, it's a play. It's like our American living room play in some way, where we're grappling with our own relationship to American identity and sort of doing it through immigration stories that are kind of immigration stories and not entirely. You know, I think, you know, Reggie Hoops, I wouldn't describe it as an immigration story because nobody's immigrating into the United States. But like you said, they're moving from the complicated neighborhood of the South Bronx into the also complicated in different ways, you know, sort of suburban area of Scarsdale. So it was cool. It was really cool working on that to see that, like, yeah, like we're both like trying to crack the same thing for ourselves, and doing it in actually really similar ways for two playwrights who don't generally write the same way. I think I'm living in Chris's world a little bit more. Well, he may say the opposite. I'm a visitor into that space in a different kind of way. But yeah, it was cool to see that there's something that is going on that we both have to make sense of for ourselves, and you know, and we're trying to do it through our plays.
Obviously, in Our Orange Sky and How to Make an American Son, you know, Chris has a very strong, recognizable onstage proxy in Orlando pretty transparently. I think in Welcome to Arroyos, there's a character who went through a similar journey as Reggie's family, right, of moving out of, but it was the Lower East Side, and kind of trying to come back and say, or just like you moved away from here, you no longer quite can claim this as your roots. And there's a little bit of that from Muncie, I feel like, in this play, of even though he especially, right, like never really grew up with any relationship to the Bronx, but definitely wants to feel like doesn't fully feel like he belongs. He's not a Scarsdale through and through. I guess I'm curious in seeing that parallel in both of those stories, whether that's a character that maybe you identify with, or if there's a you proxy in this play or your plays.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean, with the caveat, big spoiler for most of American theater, like all characters are you in some way, right? Like, I don't say that to
unless they're your parents.
Unless they're your parents, yeah. There's some version, or the version of the parents that you either wish that they were, or the perceived monster version of them. Like, taking it a bit further, so you know, we can go a little bit deeper. But we always, like, I always have to find something of myself to put into a character somewhere. But certainly, I think you're right on. Like, thinking about the things that you have to work out in your work, I definitely was working that out. I grew up in Yonkers, New York, which is Lower Westchester County. And, you know, I would say, growing up, I'd say, like, it's not as fancy as the other parts of Westchester County. because, like, being fancy or being, you know, well off or whatever that was, and we weren't, like, well off, we were, like, middle class. But, you know, being whatever that word, privileged, I guess, before we sort of had that language, in those ways, was something that I didn't want to be. And I think there were sort of cultural ideas at the time in the 90s. A lot of, you know, the big idea in hip hop music in the 90s was about keeping it real. And like that really had a sense of like, you know, early trappings of, I guess, you know, what might have turned into like progressivism now or a certain wokeness, right? But anyway, but so there's a certain amount of like feeling like, who am I to be living in a relatively nice, quiet neighborhood when members of my family are still back in a tough, gritty, much cooler you know, world that I live in. So definitely was something that I've always had sort of in the back of my mind thinking about growing up. I feel good. I've made my peace with all that stuff now. But I still, it's a fun thing to access for characters. And it's a part of this play. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that I necessarily identify completely with Muncie, but it certainly there are things about him. He's also a father. He's also a father to two little girls who is feeling like it's real hard to be a stay-at-home dad and feel unappreciated and give up, make some sacrifices, and nobody's sort of saying thank you. That's the other thing I write about all the time: people who are unappreciated for what they do. My psychology and my therapy needs are right on the table when you look at like two or three of the plays altogether. That's Chad Deity's about somebody being feeling unappreciated. But yeah, so definitely like you find other things, and then you know one of the things that's been interesting about this play is finding my connections to each of these characters, which is, you know, we always have to do that. But, you know, characters are very, 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 the things that happen to the parents in this play, one of the things is directly based on my parents. They got married in their house and they didn't tell any, in their apartment in the Bronx, and didn't tell anybody that they were getting married, and just invited people there. They also, I think they were out of the Bronx at this point, but my mother was carrying me around in her belly when the blackout happened in New York City in 1977. So you find like those things that you're sort of drawing parallels to, but then finding the ways that they're drastically changed from who you are, and then finding something within yourself to identify with, to make them a three-dimensional character. You know, particularly in the case of Reggie, I'm writing a mixed race queer woman. And it's a scary thing. It's a scary thing to say, like, do I have authority? Do I have the ability? Do I have the right to write a character like this? I think it's important that, you know, I did, because I was writing it specifically for an actor at that time. But then finding the ways to bring my elements of myself into that character that can feel relevant and believable within their experience, and then also finding out from other smart people what is, you know, what I'm hitting, what I'm getting right, what I'm missing, what's a weak spot in my knowledge that I don't know. So that part of it is a fun challenge.
One of the things that I have watched evolve over just like the past year is sort of pinning down the characters' ethnicities in more nuance. So I think, you know, Reggie has always been biracial in the draft that I was first introduced to. Her mother was white and Irish, and her father was black. Now her mother is Puerto Rican and Irish.
Puerto Rican and Irish, yeah.
And her father is black. Also, Bells, Reggie's wife, I think did not have a designated ethnicity in the first draft that I read, and now is identified as, I believe, Chinese American. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about how those things emerged as an important part of the storytelling.
Yeah, it's a real fun one because there's lots of different ways and they all sort of boil down to the same thing. When I first started writing the show, again, I was writing for some specific actors, and the actress who played Reggie was black, African American. And the actor who played her brother was Latino. And then their parents were black and white. So it was sort of like, well, this is what I got, and I want to do a family story. And I don't necessarily want to make it about that, but you also, these are the bodies that we have in space. And so you're thinking about what that was going to be. And so it helped me sort of think about what that looked like. And then while we were doing that, and I knew they were going to be mixed, and there was a lot of mixedness going on in there, and I was like, I'm really interested in the weirdness of the complexities of mixedness right now. Like, I'm Puerto Rican, my wife is Filipina, and my kids are mixed. But in a way, no, when you think mixed race, you don't think that. And Filipinos and Puerto Ricans are so similar in their cultural backgrounds, and you know, they're both like weird colonized American army base mixtures of things. That's not the only thing that was mixtures, but you know, there's complicated things. And then now you throw Asian into the mix and Native American. There's other complicated stuff. So I'm interested in the complexity of that. So I was like, well, what if their parents were both mixed race? So you had a black Puerto Rican and a white Puerto Rican marrying together. And then we could play with like, what does that mean? Like if you're a quarter Puerto Rican on this side and a quarter Puerto Rican on that side, does that make you 50% Puerto Rican when you're, you know, I wanted to play with that, but the play didn't, this is not that play. So then it became about thinking about what was going to help tell the best story. What if that was the most interesting thing, the complexity of that mixed racedness and of that family in what that meant in 1977 for those two folks to find each other and have not just different ethnic backgrounds, but different cultural and political ideas. So that sort of came into light. Then you start to work with specific people and the story changes. So every time you hire or even conceive of a specific actor in the piece, especially in a piece like this where race is present, it's not a play about race, I don't think, by any real stretch of the imagination, but race is present. As soon as you start to do that, and then you say, well, we're going to cast this actor, you have to start to, you know, or things present themselves in different kinds of ways. And so in the case of, you know, the two of the characters, worked with Ashley last year, and Ashley was fantastic. And Ashley brought a lot of really specific ideas to the table. And just in the conversations, even in things that didn't necessarily make it into the play, but in the kind of behind the scenes table work, talk about the play, we made some choices. And I said, yeah, first of all, I think you always have to be, you have to be specific about those kinds. I mean, I try not to and say like, this could be anyone. And there are some plays where that works. It could be any race. But once you start dealing with specificity of race and you're saying this actor should be other than what we have already, we've got black, we've got white, we've got a little Latino, they need to be other than that. Then A, you sort of know what that's going to be. And B, it's kind of a cop out if you don't give them a decision. It's kind of like, well, we don't really care. It could be anything. We're not interested in. Then it's like, I'm not trying to be interested in the Asian American story. Well, no, you're talking about race. If she's going to be Asian American on stage, that's part of what you're drawing from. So you got to think about it. So the long way to say Ashley's awesome. Ashley was in the mix, and then we were able to be specific about that. And then the last thing is that when we were casting this time around, our schedule moved around a little bit, and actors were available and they're not available, and we bounced around. And Melissa Crespo, who came in, is also Latino. She's half Puerto Rican, half Dominican, which is a kind of mixed racedness that we don't even have time to start thinking
right.
about. Right. Right. It's like, what is that? You know, but anyway, but Melissa came in and we were talking about, I said to her in passing, I was like, you know, like at some point they used to be Puerto Rican. And, then somebody said, you know, there's an amazing Puerto Rican mixed race actress here in town. And then we met Hulana and it was like, oh, yes. And that does really cool stuff. I mean, yes, she gets this play. She's fantastic. And her presence does really cool stuff for what we're doing here. So that's what led to that, them becoming Latino once again.
Whew. Yeah, right. Especially when you are, I mean, you mentioned, you know, folks who come from countries that have been colonized, mm-hmm. right? Then you're already almost all the time dealing with some sort of multiracial, often,
yeah.
right?
You yeah, know? Exactly. Yeah. Like I'm multiracial, but I don't know what my racial background is really.
Right.
That's like part of being Latino is you just don't know.
Totally.
You know, Puerto Rican is not its own thing, but Puerto Rican is very different than other Latino cultures because of the status that we have in the United States. We're not another country.
Totally.
So it's like, you know, you're sort of American, sort of not. And then the other part of it is that like I consider my ethnicity New Yorican.
Uh-huh.
Because New York Puerto Rican culture is a very specific thing. And I've been to Puerto Rico 3 or 4 times in my life, and it's beautiful, but it's not the culture that I grew up in. And there are beautiful, wonderful things that I love doing there. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. But it's not where I grew up. I grew up in New York City, but I didn't grow up in New York City. I grew up in the suburbs of New York City. So that's a big part of what the play is trying to deal with. It's the you know, how do we rethink about culture in a country like the United States that makes culture so complicated for so, so many reasons.
Yeah. And this is the thing that I just keep coming back to. There are all these conversations about all these plays about like American identity, right? Is that culture is really specific, but it can be specific to like a neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
It's fractal? That's not
right. No, I think you're right. Yeah, it definitely like it's fractal and fractured and all of those things. It's messy.
It's messy.
Which is fun. It's good for playwriting.
It is good. It is good. It's given us a lot of different, just given like a lot of different lenses and windows into a lot of different experiences, which I think was, mission accomplished. Yeah. Anything I should have asked you that I steal this, I think, from Ezra Klein.
Yeah, that's good place to steal.
Yeah, best place to steal.
Good place to steal. I mean, you know, it's interesting because, again, like, it's a place, we talk about race, we talk about culture, it's about that, and it's not about that. It's about basketball, but it's not really about basketball at all. It's basketball as a tool to talk about other stuff. I think it's really a play about family and the complicatedness of family. It's really trying to be in that American tradition of, like, your Horton Foote, and certainly like Lorraine Hansberry, Raising the Sun, like all those plays that take Appropriate, which is on Broadway right now, like all these plays that just take place like in the American living room, there's something about that is, I thought when I was first starting out as a writer, I was like, I hate those plays. I never want to see them. They're just people sitting on a couch talking about their problems, but they've got money because they own a home, and like hated it. And I've gotten older and I own a home and I have a family, and that's part of it. And also sort of now understanding what's going on in those kinds of plays, and that there, you know, there's a lot of value to take away from them. And then just how that sort of traditional story about like the American home, or, you know, where we live, gets evolved and complicated, not just by race, not just by gender, but by class. Sexuality is a huge, huge, huge part of this. So again, a huge part of the play, but that's not sort of like the focus of it. But it is a fact that it's at its core is a hopefully loving and hopefully complicated three-dimensional relationship between two female-identifying folks. And it's so trying to find ways to just complicate is sort of what we're doing, and hopefully complicating in a way that can still be fun and accessible and all those good things.
Yeah. It's Dan Harris from 10% Happier, not Ezra Klein. Oh. I do love Ezra Klein, but it's Dan Harris who ends all of his interviews with, what's something I should have asked you that I didn't? Ezra Klein asks for book recommendations.
Oh.
Do you have book recommendations?
Oh man. I wish yes, but I can't. I mean, the best book is The Princess Bride, which most people know as a movie, but the book is good, and fantastic. It's as good as a book as the movie is as a movie, and the movie is perfect. So maybe
imagine
it's a perfect
that.
Book. I don't know, but it's so different. And a lot of people don't necessarily know the book. It's the weirdest book. And it's really, really, really good. And then I feel like I should at least show that I've read a book, in the last, like, however many years. And I'm blanking on every book that I've read ever other than that. So when it's just The Princess Bride, which I'll maybe go back and read again after I just said this.
Yeah, I feel like that's reasonable. In the same genre, The Neverending Story is a totally different book than the movie. And the movie is great, but it's like the first chapter of that book. Okay, great. Thank you so much. I'm going to let you grab a quick bite to eat and get back to rehearsal and making the magic.
Awesome. Thank you.
Once again, huge thanks to Christopher Diaz for taking the time to be here in Portland, to be in rehearsals, and to sit down and chat with me about the show. The world premiere of Reggie Hoops opens Saturday, August 3rd, and runs through Sunday, August 11th at Imago Theater. There are previews on August 1st and 2nd. Members of the LGBTQIA+ community can join us for Pride Night,
Thursday, August 1st, we also feature a BIPOC Affinity Night, Thursday, August 8th. Our affinity nights include a pre-show reception with free drinks and snacks and a ticket to the show for only $5 and a chance to win a door prize. For tickets to Affinity Night or any of our performances, please visit profiletheater.org. We hope to see you at the theater.